You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. Today we've got a stumped for you. This is where Scott and I will try to stump each other with interview questions. We are going to, again, last time we coded up a little AI prompt and used that to generate all the questions because we have pretty much run out of interview question websites over the years. And it seems that the AI is the endless fount of really good questions and answers. So let's get on into it. I'll start it off here with the first one for Scott. The first question is, in which year was JavaScript introduced? And I have a set of options here that I'm able to give A, B, or C. And I'm not going to say them by default, but if you say, all right, I need a hint, then I'll give you the possible options.
Yeah, I think for this one, because it is such a... I could guess, but I'm not going to be correct. So if I had options, I think I would do better.
Mm. All right, you want me to give you... I'll give you the options. 1993, 94, or 95?
Those are all too close. I was hoping they'd be a little bit more spread out. I am going to say 1995.
Got it. Nailed it.
Do you know why I went with 1995?
Why?
Was because that's what I was going to guess before you gave me the prompt. So but I wasn't confident on that. I was maybe at a 5 out of 10 on the confidence scale. So.
Yes, it was created by Brendan Eich, who worked at Netflix at the time. He's a creator of JavaScript.
He worked at Netflix?
Oh, not Netflix. Netscape. Imagine you worked at Netflix. I don't think Netflix was around.
I don't think it was around in 2005, let alone 1995. That's hilarious.
I wonder when was... Okay, there's a follow-up question. When was Netflix?
Netflix.
Launched.
2002.
Wow. I'm surprised. 97.
No, I don't believe that. Who'd you ask that? Did you ask ChatGPT that?
No, that's... it's from Wikipedia.
What did they even do? Because DVDs really didn't.
That was so Netflix was created before Google? No.
Mail-based rental business in 1997. Yeah. Was it just VHS?
Google was founded in 98. Like, yeah, when was DVDs?
Down the rabbit hole we go. Yeah.
This is the rabbit hole. The DVD was invented in 95. So there's no way the DVD was ready for rental in 97. So it must have been VHS.
What a wild thing. I would have never have guessed that. That's interesting. All right. Here's a question for you, Wes. Which HTTP status code is typically returned by the server when a requested resource is not found? Oh, come on. That's too easy.
That's easy one. 404.
Yeah. That's easy. Too easy.
Yeah. With this prompt, you can sort of come back at it and say, give me an extremely hard one about X, Y, or Z.
Okay, let me say, I'm saying give me a harder one about HTTP status codes.
Okay.
So which HTTP status code indicates that the client must authenticate itself to get the requested response?
Oh,
I know this one.
403 unauthorized?
It's, would you like the options?
No, yeah, give me the options. Okay, this is good. Because I don't want to just hear the answer yet.
Okay, options are 401, 403, and 409.
It's 409.
It's 401. I just had to write that like a bunch of times when I'm doing the, you know, the off
what is,
part.
What is the 409 status code?
That's a great question. I don't know. Never use it.
Status code conflicts indicates that the request could not be processed because of a conflict in the request, such as a requested resource is not in the expected state or the result of the process request would create a conflict with the resource.
Hmm.
Oh, never used that one before.
Yeah, I have not either.
What is a pseudo class and could you give an example of one?
Yeah, a pseudo class as opposed to like a pseudo element, I suppose. A pseudo class would be like hover to be able to select something if its current status is being hovered. Is that correct? Is that a pseudo class? Yeah.
A pseudo class is a keyword that can be added to a selector to style elements that are in a particular state or position, such as hover, which applies states when the user hovers over an element. Got it.
Okay, JavaScript question. What JavaScript function allows you to delay the execution of a function until a certain number of milliseconds has passed?
Set timeout. I find like some of these are too easy. I gotta figure out how to give it even harder ones.
Yeah, it tells me a difficulty level medium. I'm going to say no more medium ones because we're not medium.
Mid. So this one's telling me this is a very hard. What's the difference between a media query and a conditional statement in JavaScript? That makes no sense because the answer is one's in CSS and one is in. No. Okay. All right. Maybe we need to tweak this prompt.
Yeah. The joys better. Of AI here.
I like this one. Who first proposed the idea of using separate style sheet language for the web and when?
Who, by name, or can I give you a browser?
It looks like the answer is a name and a year.
Oh, I don't know a name here, but I would imagine it is an Internet Explorer at some point. So maybe somebody that worked at Microsoft, but I'm not sure. Can I get some options here?
The first answer is Haikan Woon Lee in 1994 while he was working at CERN with Tim Berners-Lee. B, Brendan Eich in 1995 when he was developing JavaScript. Or C, John Rezig in 2006 while he was working on the jQuery library.
You know what? I'm going to say Brendan Eich only because that year.
The answer is Haikan Woon Lee so I'm just looking up his Wikipedia, a Norwegian web pioneer and standards activist, CTO of Opera Software.
Okay.
Until the browser was sold to its new owners in 2016. He was best known for developing cascading style sheets while working with Tim Berners-Lee and Robert Kailau at CERN in 1994. And CERN is the, European Organization for Nuclear Research? No, that doesn't.
You don't know CERN?
No, I don't think I do.
They do the big Hadron Collider. That's CERN.
They're slamming
particles together.
And they develop CSS?
Yeah, well, first they had to slam style sheets into the browser.
Slam some style sheets together. Well, that's interesting that it was proposed to do a separate style sheet rather than do it inside of your HTML, I guess, or no, maybe even, like, was CSS only inline at first?
Who knows? And if only we could find that out. All right, next question is, which of the following statements about JavaScript's strict mode are true? Okay?
So this is good.
Which of the following are true? Use strict makes all global variables local to the script. Use strict enables additional JavaScript debugging features. Use strict changes previously accepted bad syntax into real errors.
The third one, use strict makes previously accepted bad syntax into actual JavaScript errors.
Ding, ding, ding.
Oh, that was a good one.
Yeah, not bad.
Oh, so also with this AI is I'm able to input your answer and see if it's good enough, which is kind of cool. So my question here is, what is event-driven programming in Node.js and how does it work?
In Node.js?
Yeah. We had one similar to this on the last Stumped, I think. It's not exactly it.
Event-driven programming. I don't know. It makes me think of signals. But I don't know what kind of answer this is looking for.
Well, shoot me your answer. I'll give it to the robot and see what they think.
Event-driven programming is programming where you're using events as the main form of, I don't know a good way to distill this thought other than just saying, hey, it's by responding and listening to events, which doesn't feel like a complete
answer. All right, I'm going to say event-driven programming is responding and listening to events. Let's see what it tells you. You are correct. No, it's not. Basically, I apologize for this mistake in my previous question. No, you were right. So the answer here is event-driven programming is a programming paradigm where the flow of the program is determined by events that are received by the program at runtime. It works in Node.js by using the event loop and continually listens for events that are associated with callback functions
when
events are detected. Event That's loop. The whole event loop behind JavaScript, right? You throw stuff on the event loop. When it comes back, you are resolved.
Yeah, that makes way too much sense. Okay, here's a good one. In GraphQL, how do you mark a field or type in the schema as deprecated?
It's at deprecated on the field, so you would do it after the field name.
Correct.
Bing, ding, 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 ding. All right, here is a good one. What was the primary motivation for the development of XHTML, and how did it differ from HTML?
XHTML, you know what? I'm guessing that the XHTML I'm basing this on the assumption that XHTML is XML because that is what I understand about XHTML, and if it's not, then this whole answer is incorrect. So basically, it was developed to pass data rather than structure.
The answer here is the primary motivation for the development of XHTML was to provide a more strict and standardized version of HTML that was compatible with HTML, while HTML was more loose and browser-specific markup language. I think that's pretty close.
Yeah. I'm not going to give myself credit for it. I'm not feeling positive about it.
All right.
In JavaScript, if you create a new my object from a constructor, my constructor, which of the following is true? Okay. So you've created a new object from a constructor. Which of the following is true? My object dot underscore underscore proto underscore underscore score is equal to my constructor. My object, I'm just going to say dot proto, okay?
Yeah.
My object dot proto is equal to my constructor dot prototype. My object dot proto is equal to my constructor dot underscore underscore proto. So we're talking about is the prototype or the my object dot underscore underscore proto equal to my constructor dot prototype, or my constructor dot underscore underscore prototype?
It is constructor.prototype because the first one is the class itself. And if you want something to be inherited, you put it on the prototype. And then the underscore underscore proto is how you literally reach into something that has already been instantiated and to modify its prototype.
Yes. Beauty.
Woo! Well, that was a good one. I like that.
It was. I'm actually impressed because just having to say all of those things was a bit much.
You did good summarizing it. This is a weird one. This one seems kind of cheap, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Okay.
What is a type eraser in TypeScript, and how does it affect the generated JavaScript code?
What is a type eraser? And how does it affect the JavaScript code? I've never heard of this. Let me take a wild stab in the dark. A type eraser. And how does it affect the JavaScript code? This is a trick question. Does it not affect the JavaScript code? I want to say a type eraser removes the type and does not affect the JavaScript code.
It's a long way of saying when TypeScript is compiled, it removes the types because JavaScript doesn't understand the types at all, right?
Yeah. So
the process of compiling it, I guess, is called type eraser. Very nice.
All right, next question here. In TypeScript, which syntax can be used to define a user-defined type guard?
I know this one because I just recorded a video on it. So in TypeScript, when you write a user-defined type guard, you write a function that returns true or false. However, the return type of that function is not a Boolean. The return type is. So you would say, like, you take in animal, and you say animal is pet. Or in our case, we have a food type that could be a sandwich or a pizza. And we needed to write a type guard that says this food is pizza. So we needed to narrow it down from a food, which could be a sandwich or a pizza, down to all the way down to just pizza.
What an answer. Wonderful.
Yeah. You know what's a funny thing? Maybe we'll talk about that really quickly, is that filter in types in JavaScript does not type guard. So like, let's say you had like an array of strings and numbers and you filtered for just numbers. Simply filtering alone is not enough to narrow the type from string and number down to just number. So you have to say the return type of your filter is number. And then that will make TypeScript smarten up. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of weird that it doesn't do that, but I guess it's the limitation of TypeScript and its like static nature.
Mm-hmm. There's like certainly times when I'm writing TypeScript where I'm like, I feel like you should,
you should
understand
know.
That this you can only know. Be a string. You should get it, right? We all get it.
Here's a good one. This is something we have a show on that's coming up. What is a closure in JavaScript and how is it used?
Yeah. And this is one of those concepts that I should know, but in practice, I almost never really, really care too much about a closure. A closure is a function that could have, when I was studying for things, I could have told you exactly like the parroted version that you'd get off of a how-to site. A closure is a function that returns a function with its own scope.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way of putting it. Where you have a function, and then inside of that function you have variables, and then you return a function from that. And that inner function is able to access the outer scope of the parent function, so that you can sort of carry around data by calling that function over and over again. So the big example is always like a counter, right? You have a function called make counter, mm-hmm. and then that returns an increment function. And every single time you run that increment function, it still has access to this like invisible variable of the upper scope. We've had a card on it for like 2 months probably. And we should probably do that one.
Yeah, I think that's one of those topics, especially like a lot of developers, they hear the term and it sounds like a jargony type of term, or they see it being used and it's like, all right, when am I actually using this in my own JavaScript is always a different question, right? All right, next one is, which of the following internal Node.js modules provides asynchronous file I/O? I'm not going to give you them because then you're going to get it.
Okay, which of the following provides asynchronous file I/O? That's the FS/promises library.
Sure. Or just FS. But yes, FS.
Yeah, yeah. Well, FS. Yeah, I guess so. Because even like the callback.
Because FS, it's like a
subset. Yeah, the FS callback functions are still asynchronous, right? But they're just callback based instead of being promise based. But they also have a set of synchronous functions as well, which is, it always frustrates me when you see people do little demos and they always use the write file sync.
FS.writeFileSync,
just because then they don't have to get into callbacks or whatever. And it's bad practice to do that. You shouldn't be using that because it locks up your entire application. So it's much better to use the await FS.writeFilePromise, which is now available. It has been for quite a while. This is a good one. In programming, what does memory safety mean?
Memory safety is that you're not using more RAM than is available from the computer.
I think that's pretty good. So memory safety is a property of programming languages and their compilers and runtimes that ensures programs do not have undefined behavior related to memory management. Achieving memory safety implies that the program's memory access, read and write, are well-defined and do not violate memory safety rules. Common memory safety violations include dereferencing null or invalid pointers, accessing memory out of bounds, buffer overflow or underflow, and memory leaks. These errors can lead to program crashes, security vulnerabilities, and undefined behaviors. I remember when I learned C in university, as I took one computer science class, we had to like define our own memory, which is weird. In JavaScript, you want to make a variable, you just make it. And or you want to make a string, who cares how big that string is, right? You just do it and the JavaScript will figure out how much memory it needs. And then you're no longer using that string. It's nowhere longer referenced anywhere. Then that's what garbage collection is. And the JavaScript will clean up. So in some programming language, you have to manage all of that yourself. You have to kind of know ahead of them. Even like with the new syntax website, with the MySQL, I just made like a string varchar 255 or whatever. And then I had some text that was too long for that. And
you had to make it up whatever.
Yeah, I had to change it to a text type. And there's like so many different string inputs in MySQL, whereas even with numbers, right? A number is a number, a JavaScript, a string is a string, and that's it.
That's one of the things that I had to pick up in Rust, how many different types there are. In Rust, you have so many different types based on all kinds of things. So you're always having to consider a little bit more. You're not just working with a number. You're working with different types of, you know, an 8-bit integer, an unsigned 8-bit integer, a 16-bit integer, any of that stuff. So it's a different world having to worry about memory here. I watched, Displaced Gamers is a YouTube channel where they get really nitty gritty into the RAM. So like the entire premise of the channel is he like does kind of step through debugging in real video games, like NES video games. And we'll talk about how you can watch the RAM and see how this change in RAM value actually, here's all the RAM slots. And here's the specific amount of RAM slots. And they only have this many. So here are the tricks they're doing to swap out things out of the different RAM slots so that they have room for it. It's a very wild world.
That's crazy.
All right. Next question for you is, what mechanism does HTTP2 introduce to reduce latency and improve the loading speed of web pages? I can give you parameters.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to figure out what the word is, where HTTP2 essentially allows the server to send multiple resources over a single connection. And there's a specific word for that. It's not like muxing. Can you give me the option?
Ooh, it's close to muxing. It starts with an M. Oh, I just blew it then. You're hot.
Multiplying? Give me, what's the answer?
You're what so is close. It? Multiplexing.
Multiplexing. Ah, isn't that what muxing is?
You are just,
multi.
I don't know. Muxing versus multiplexing.
The abbreviation used to represent a multiplexer is mux. Okay, I was right. All right.
Oh, okay. Okay, look at you. I did not know that. That's you stumped the stumper and the question.
There's like I'm trying to think. You know, like your cable. If you have cable on your TV, there's like one wire, right? And you think like, how can all these TV shows go over one wire? Or sometimes people,
they got all these shows on one wire.
Yeah, on one wire. Or like sometimes people, you can run like power line adapter. You can run internet on your home's power. Like how do they do that with one or two wires? And the answer to that is they multiplex it, meaning that they put it into a single thing at one end, send it over the wire, and then once it hits the other end, they unpack it, they demux it. Ooh, this is a good one. What are some strategies for optimizing the performance of HTML5 video on a web page, particularly for mobile devices?
Well, I mean, streaming, one. You stream it rather than straight up just reference and play the file.
The entire video file?
Yeah. So that's probably the biggest one. What else could you do? You could compress it. You could compress the source video using a different codec. You could lower the quality of it. You could lower the file size. You could preload it. And I don't know what else. What else would be there?
That's good. So I think you got it right. Is that you can chop it up into multiple things, which is your idea of streaming it. You send multiple files at once. You can compress it, you said, so you can change both the bit rate and the resolution. That was a kind of an interesting one. I talked to the folks from Mux at a conference recently, and I was telling them about the pains of doing coding videos, because when you're compressing, specifically, I was trying to use the, what's Descript? And the output of Descript always was just a little bit muddy on the text. And I think the answer to that is because most people are compressing video where they want the typical compression. Yeah, is that you can have you want a high resolution but a lower bit rate and it looks pretty fine. But I guess with mine, because it's text, you want really crisp. It's kind of the opposite, where you want a extremely high bit rate because you want as much information as possible, but the resolution is not nearly as important. And I think that's why the Descript doesn't allow you to turn any bit rate knobs. They only allow you to select your output resolution. And I think that's why the videos never quite looked. And it's the reason why I was not able to use Descript, because their videos just didn't look all that nice. So the one answer they have here is use a CDN. CDNs offer faster video loading by serving the video from a server closer to the user's location.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess that tracks. In JavaScript, which of the following is not a correct way to create a new object which inherits an existing object? Ooh. Const new object equals object.create old object. New object is equal to brackets spread operator old object. New object is equal to new old object dot constructor. So which of these is not a correct way of creating a new object which inherits from an existing old object?
I'm going to say the dot constructor version. The spread one is weird to me, because that only takes a copy of the top level ones and then will reference nested values, which is maybe what you want, because the prototype will be looked up. So I'm going to say the dot constructor.
Okay. Well, they have the answer as the spread operator. The reason why, and honestly, from the wording of the question, it makes me wonder about that. So I asked it specifically, why isn't the spread operator one correct here? And it says that the spread operator creates a new object and copies over the old properties from old object. However, while it does copy the properties of old object, it does not set up the prototype chain. This means new object will not have old object in its prototype chain, and it does not truly inherit from old object.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, but I don't know if the wording of the question was wonderful. Yeah.
All right, I got one for you here. What is the difference between function declarations and function expressions in JavaScript, and when should each be used?
A function declaration is defining a function, where a function expression is simply, it's creating... Yeah, because the function expression doesn't actually create the function. To create a function from a function expression, you put it into a variable. So it is a function itself is the function expression, where a function declaration is defining and saving it as a function. And yeah, I know it in practice, but what's the answer here? Like, what is an expression specifically?
I think you got the answer there. Maybe talk about the differences. Can I have a follow-up question? It's like, what's the difference? Like, why would you want to use a function declaration over a function expression, or vice versa?
A function expression can be used without giving the function a name and defining it. So it can be used without defining it.
Okay, that's good. You're right. So a function expression is where you put a named or unnamed function into a variable. So you say const my function equals, And it could be a regular function. It could be a arrow function. It's just basically a function as a value. Whereas a function declaration is where you write the word function and then you declare what it is. So the difference between the two is function declarations are hoisted, whereas function expressions are not hoisted.
Interesting. Yeah, I never think about hoisting, ever.
Sounds delicious. Hoistus.
All right. It does. Hoisin is one of my favorite things in the whole world. So, yeah.
I went this weekend looking for that Japanese barbecue sauce that you were saying. What's it called?
I'm gonna mess it up if I try to do it off memory. It's a Costco special right now.
Bakken's?
Yeah, something like that.
They didn't have it out of Costco. I've been wanting it for so long. It looks delicious.
It is, and we just made like a stir fry the other day, and I was like, oh man, this is the perfect use case this. Let me just go nuts on this, and it was lovely. It's like a nice little teriyaki vibe to it. All right, next question in JavaScript. What is the value of this inside of an arrow function defined within a non-arrow function?
The value of this is not redefined when you're inside of an arrow function, so it will simply just go up the scope chain until it finds something that is this, and in your case, this will be equal to the parent function.
Beauty.
I like that. This is a good question. We kind of answered this one, but I think you could have a good answer for this. In TypeScript, what is a type guard and how is it used to ensure type safety in your code?
What is a type guard? Type guard is basically a checkpoint to confirm a specific type. So typically, if you have maybe like a type that is could be multiple things, maybe it's a union. You're trying to access a property on something that doesn't exist. You need a type guard to step in here and say, hey, if this thing is the following type, then we can continue with this code, potentially accessing, methods on a string if you have guarded it to be that it is, in fact, a string. So it's basically, like I said, a checkpoint to only allow a specific type through.
Beautiful. And can I ask a follow-up question?
You may.
What is the difference between a type guard and a type assertion, or sometimes called a type cast?
A type cast casts a spell onto a type. It says, you are this. It says, a type cast is essentially not forcing, but it's telling something what type it is, where a type guard is checking what type it is.
Beautiful. Yeah, I always say the type assertion is the trust me, bro. Whereas a type guard is literally making sure that it is before you go ahead.
Yeah.
Nailed it. Double points for that one.
Yeah.
It's a bouncer. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. No, let's see that ID. All right. All right. In JavaScript, what is the order of execution of the following tasks? Okay. The order of execution, macro tasks, micro tasks, and rendering tasks.
Macro, micro, and rendering. Whoa.
So which of those are first? So a macro task is something like set timeout. A micro task is something like a promise or a callback. And a rendering task is something like request animation frame.
Man,
so what is the order of execution?
Okay. So let me write this down again. So you said a macro is set timeout?
You could imagine this. You have a set timeout, a promise callback, and a request animation frame. Which of those, or what's the order in which those are executed?
I'm going to say micro, micro promise, then request animation frame, and then macro. The only reason I say that is because the trick to put something at the end of the event loop is to put a set timeout with 0 milliseconds, and that will stick it on the end of the event loop. Make sure the rendering is often happening in Jest testing or like React testing library where you're like, it's not rendered yet. Set a set timeout of 0, and then it will make sure that it's rendered before then.
So according to the answer, Wes, it is macro micro rendering. But your answer makes sense. So
micro rendering.
The order of execution is macro, micro, rendering.
Interesting. Because a set timeout, I guess, gets called immediately, but the callback of set timeout would be a micro task.
Yeah.
And that is put to the end, but it's still going before rendering. That's a good question. That's like really nitty gritty. I bet we should dig into that, or maybe get somebody on to talk about the order of operations.
Yeah, I would be into that.
That was a good one. All right, I like this. So we have different versions of ECMAScript. You know, like ES6 is probably the most popular one that you know about. There's one version of ECMAScript that was never finalized and therefore scrapped. Which version was that?
Oh, because we ES4.
Got it.
Yeah.
How did you know that?
Because I remember that ES5 was the one that was, you know, everybody talked about as being ES5.
Yeah.
And I remember the reason why that was like a big deal was because the version before that was a cluster of not being able to be.
Yeah.
So that's all I remember about that specifically.
So ECMAScript version 4 was the version of ECMAScript specification was never finished. It started in 2000, but was abandoned in 2008. Due to disagreements among the committee members, some of the features that were proposed for ECMAScript were eventually added to later versions of the specification, while others were abandoned or reworked. Ooh, experience led to changes in ECMAScript standardization process, including focus on smaller, more incremental changes and more open, transparent decision making. That's crazy. So ECMAScript 3 was launched in 99. So ECMAScript 1, 97, 2, 98. 399,
mm-hmm.
5, 2009. So 10 years between that. It's actually wild to me to think that 99 to 2009 is 10 years. And then ECMAScript ES6 was 2015, which we're almost 10 years from the launch of that.
That is very wild.
Yeah, you could tell me that that was launched just last week, and I would have said, oh, yeah. So what was scrapped in ECMAScript? Oh, classes were proposed. That's actually funny because we didn't get classes until we hit ES6.
Yeah.
10 years later, packages. ECMAScript 4 proposal included a module system based on packages that would have to enable developers to identify the origin of particular code modules.
Whoa.
This two-faced disagreement in the module system was reworked and eventually added in a more limited version form in the specification. Generators, that was added in ES6. Oh, you're going to like this one. Typing annotations. ECMAScript 4 proposed optional typing annotations to JavaScript, which would have enabled static analysis and verification of code. However, this aspect of the proposal was not well received and was abandoned in favor of alternate. Is that true?
Yeah, sometimes you got to just say, is that true? To if you're getting this information off of,
yeah, there's a post on esdiscuss.org from 16 years ago.
Oh,
I'm still
gosh.
Working on my static analysis tool for ES4. This tool will make use of custom type or type like annotation. I wonder if there's already syntax guidelines for something like this. So it was proposed. That's wild. And then the last one is meta classes and meta objects. ES4 proposed features for meta object programming, which enables dynamic programming techniques like introspection and reflection. However, this proved to be too complex and was subsequently dropped from the proposal. I think we have those now, both with the reflection is via the proxy API, custom getters and setters, and I think the meta object thing or meta classes is the decorator proposal. So here we are, 20 years later, we got them.
That
would have been a good show on its own. Just discover deep into ES4 and what happened, the real truth. We could do like one of those clickbaity videos.
I was working on something that was like the history of Internet Explorer myself, like diving through each version and like what it brought
that would be cool
to the table. So we can have something in that realm. All right, next question here is, what is the result of the following comparison in JavaScript? You have empty array brackets is double equal sign, exclamation point, empty array brackets.
So what is the, what, so basically empty array, double equals, bang, empty array, right? What's the correct output of that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so empty array is its own object. Another empty array is its own object, but a bang in front of that. So empty array is still something. So it's true. So bang is equal to false. So that would be, and a double equals checks the only the type. So the output of that would be, basically you're saying is true, double equals false. And so the answer to that would be false.
So I invite you, if you're sitting in front of a computer, to type this in. If you're listening to the show, you can do empty array brackets, two equals, bang, empty arrays, hit enter. And true. Once that bad boy says true. This question involves JavaScript's loose equality operator type coercion and how JavaScript interprets different values in Boolean context. So this is all of you newer developers out there. When you hear people say, hey, use the triple equals because the double equals can do some weird stuff. This is one of those things where you're like, I don't know why that would work that way, but it does.
So an empty array is truthy when using the double equals operator, but an empty array, no, an empty array is falsy when using the double equals. That's crazy. Well, that was a good one.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, this is kind of interesting. This is another history one.
Okay.
What were some of the major criticisms of CSS early on and how were they addressed later in later developments of the languages?
Criticisms of CSS?
Yeah.
Okay, so criticisms of CSS would have been, well, based on one of the questions we'd asked earlier, I'm going to go ahead and say how they're defined, like what in what file they're defined, and therefore yep. they were pushed into separate files in later versions. What kind of issues would people have with CSS when it first came out? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, other than that, what other kind of issues? Maybe limited amount of colors, not ability to use typefaces and fonts, which were all addressed. Positioning stuff, which was addressed by floating initially. Yeah, I don't know. I guess for me, I don't know what that initial feature set would have been that it came out with.
It goes way back. One of the main criticisms of CSS early on was it was too complex and difficult yeah. for web designers to learn and use. At the time, there were only a handful of web browsers, each with varying levels of support for CSS, which made it difficult to create consistent designs that looked the same across browsers. Mm. It's true, that was
browser, yeah,
very point, early yeah. in my career, but I certainly felt that. Another criticism was CSS lacked certain features that were important for layout, such as the ability to position elements, you said that, relative to other page elements, or to create grid-based layouts. To address the issues, CSS underwent several developments over the years. For example, with the release of CSS 2 in 1998, CSS introduced many of the features to make it rich and a powerful styling language, such as selectors, cascade, and inheritance, positioning, selectors, and the box model. To address the issue of browser compatibility, web browsers began to adopt standardized implementations of CSS. The introduction of Internet Explorer 5.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In 1999, became a major milestone in this regard. Can you imagine getting CSS Internet Explorer 5 and be like, finally, this is yeah. so much better?
It's funny. You know, I think you could, depending on how far back you went in the history of CSS, you could think yeah. of like every single release as being something that solved some criticism of CSS over the years. It's just one of those ones that's constantly evolving, constantly growing.
What did you do before the box model? You know, I guess it was just text documents. Yeah.
Yeah. Font, I remember BG very sound. Specifically doing tables for everything, not even thinking about the box model, not even really thinking about margins and any of that stuff, and just dropping stuff in a table and then using table cells to shift the layout in all kinds of ways. And and really not even thinking about CSS. It wasn't until Zen Garden came about when I was like, oh, you can do so much without tables.
When did CSS Zen Garden come out?
95. Just because that's been a good year for me this episode.
CSS Zen Garden was launched May 8th, 2003.
Oh, 2003.
It was created by designer and developer Dave Shea and demonstrated the power and flexibility of CSS. I wonder what Dave Shea is up to these days. Is a hockey player. Damn, hockey players always ruin search for everybody. Canadian has a Wikipedia.
I thought you were talking about the hockey players. Like, you're surprised that the hockey player is Canadian?
Oh, no. Dave Shea is a Canadian web designer. Mezzo Blue on Twitter. Oh, I follow him. I didn't know that he was the guy that made this. Wow. Has an article about CSS sprites from 2004. Man, this has been a whole history lesson. I'm glad I threw some of those history questions into the prompt because this has been kind of interesting to learn.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, I agree. And that's like, I'm actually very interested in that kind of stuff anyway. So
yeah, maybe we should try have some of these like maybe we'll do like a once every 2 months, we'll have like a history episode where we have somebody on from the early days. That'd be kind of fun. Maybe we should make a list of like, what were the major milestones of web development? And we'll have them on. Like jQuery is probably a big one. CSS Zen Garden's a big one. Tweet us at SyntaxFM. We'd love to hear what you think about what major milestones over the web development should be covered. Eric Myers probably should have on. We've talked to him a couple times about coming on, so maybe we should push that through. Preprocessor. Oh, like Compass and SAS was probably a big one. And some of the Paul Irish stuff. Yeah, maybe we'll start a new, like, once every 2 months history episode.
I would love to do a history episode. Absolutely. Count me in.
Yeah. All right. I'm putting it on the books. Let's move into the next section of the episode, which is our sick picks. You have a sick pick for me today?
Yeah. So I'm going to sick pick a projector. We got a laser projector for outside.
Ooh.
And normally this thing is like $900 and it's on sale for like $600, which is a lot of money. But a projector like is something we've been looking at for a long time. We don't have very many TVs in our house. We just have like the one TV in the living room, in the family room or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But we really wanted something for outside, especially like we're going to have the cousins over and they want to watch movies and stuff. It would be really nice to be able to have something outside. So we looked into like getting a cheapo TV to have outside. And ultimately we're like, wait, why don't we just get a really bright projector?
Yeah.
And so we got this little laser projector that works off of battery even. And you can cast to it. You can plug in HDMI to it. And it can work off of battery and be like, if we're just going to hang outside for the night, you could just plug in this projector. And now what we have to do is get a screen, because that's the next step, is to get a screen. But I've had this thing for like a day and I was just playing around with it. And it does like auto focusing. It works off of battery. It has cast. And I found it to be really super bright. It's probably not going to be that bright during the daytime of things. But I was really impressed with it. So I'll post a link to the specific one. And I didn't realize even like laser projectors were a thing. I used to work as a projectionist, as I may have told you before. And they used to have to be these massive units with big old heavy bright halogen bulbs and whatever. Yeah. You touch the bulbs and you're ruining them. So the fact that this little thing, it looks like a little tiny device, has such a powerful output with not having to ever replace the bulb and stuff, is just kind of amazing to me. So I'll stick pick the specific one I got. But just to, in general, having a little Bluetooth battery-powered projector, I think, is a sick pick.
That's really cool. I've been seeing those for a while where people are like, oh, just throw one in your room or whatever. And we've been looking at our basement TV. We're hopefully going to move it into our... It's starting to go. Like, you can see around the edges, it's starting to get like brownish. And we're like, we'll just throw that in the gym. And then we're thinking about getting either a new TV, but part of us is just like, maybe we should do like a huge ass projector, because they're a lot more affordable than they used to be. Like, we have a 10-year-old BenQ projector at our cottage, And that thing is amazing. Like, it's so nice and clear. You can't run it during the day. And I'm assuming the lasers are probably better at that type of thing. But I'm always amazed at how good that can be. And you can make the TV very big with it.
Very big. A lot of people are saying the TV is very big. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to sick pick a USB-C and a 32-watt three-port charger. I bought these before we went on our trip. And it's the best way to charge all of your stuff all at once. So there's two USB-A's and then there's one USB-C that does power delivery. And it's just like when you're traveling and you go back to the hotel, you need to juice your phone up as fast as possible.
Everything.
So
yeah.
If you get one of these crappy, like I have so many crappy little nubs, or we call them nubs, like the AC-DC adapter. And so many crappy cables. And I'm starting to be like, I'm going to start throwing these out because they come for free with like, you buy something and it comes for free with like a crappy cable. And
yeah,
they
and
just slow you. They're so slow. If you get a bad cable or a bad charger, they're so brutally slow. And sometimes my phone can't even keep up. But I bought like a proper one. I got two of them for $20. And
what brand?
It's one of these stupid Amazon brands, Wudenta. You know, but been a big fan of it. I know Unker also sells really high quality stuff. I have a bunch of theirs where it will figure out how fast the device can charge. And man, I'm so happy with these. Also, like my wife is a cable mover. I always make fun of her. I'm just like, stop.
Oh, I'm a cable mover too.
Oh, yeah. The rule in our house is don't, like, I almost want to just like bolt it to the thing. Don't move a cable, like, because then you're like, where's the cable for this? And you're like, well, I think I brought it to the cottage. I think it's in my backpack. It's just buy a good cable and leave it where you need them and you will always have them.
Yeah, but if I need it in another room right now, I can unplug this one and take it to the other room right now.
Get one for where you need it. So like I have nice cables at my desk. I have a nice cable beside my bed. We have a really nice charging station for all the kids' iPads and all that stuff. And it's just, life is better when you don't have to figure out where are the cables. And oh, that one's not fast enough. Don't plug that one in. So I'll link up the one I got. Cable movers. I don't know. You can't live your life like that.
I don't mind, honestly. It's just quite all right for me. I'm going to shamelessly plug Sentry at sentry.io. Sentry is the perfect place to see all of your errors and exceptions happen. We're working on software right now, and we're using Sentry in our site. And we're even getting alerts anytime there's something wrong, even though nobody's using the site other than us right now. And unfortunately, it means I'm getting a lot of alerts because I keep breaking stuff. But if you have software that people are actually using and you want to know that things are broken when they're broken, but also you want to know that they're going to be fast ahead of time, you want to know that everything is going to work as it should be, then you really need a tool like Sentry in your life. And really, Sentry is the best of them. So check it out at sentry.io. Use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, and you'll get 2 months for free of this awesome service.
Shameless plug, westboss.com/courses for a list of all of my courses. Check it on out. Use coupon code Syntax for $10 off. That's all for today. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and we will catch you later.
Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.